This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. After years of back and forth about whether it should have been built at all, the so-called busway, dubbed CTE Fast Track, has now celebrated its 1 millionth trip. But how's it really doing? Meanwhile, only a few months into a new fiscal budget, the Malloy administration made some cuts this week that seemed to upset towns and hospitals, Democrats and Republicans. And while Connecticut rushes into a deal with our tribes to build a new casino stop on the road to Springfield, it's looking like that MGM plan in the city is a little less grand than originally planned. Those are just a few of the stories we'll tackle in the Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. You can always join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, WNPR.org/where we live. You can always find us on Facebook and on Twitter at Where We Live. Joining us, as always, is Colin McEnroe. He's the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Hello, Colin.
Bernie Sanders. Ho, 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 Mr. Dankosky.
Thank you, Bernie Sanders. Thank you so much for getting that out of the way early. Christine Stewart is here. She's editor of CTNewsJunkie.com. Hello, Christine.
Good morning, John.
And Matt Kaufman is an investigative reporter for The Hartford Current. Hello there once again, Matt.
Good morning, Mr. Dankosky.
So last week,
I was doing that for Colin.
Just for Colin's sake, actually, Christine, technically, you should call me Mr. Dankosky too for the rest of the show. last week, the Wheelhouse pulled double duty. We broadcast on Wednesday and Thursday to cover the state primaries. We spent so much time talking about Bridgeport that when we first started planning the show, we thought there's nothing else to talk about as far as Bridgeport politics. We couldn't talk about anymore. Now it seems as though Bridgeport has given us a whole month's worth of stuff to talk about. Maybe we can explain quickly, Colin, what has transpired in Bridgeport since last week when Joe Ganim, the man who went to jail after serving as mayor of Bridgeport, came back in a huge political comeback and won the primary last week. That, we thought that was odd, but a lot of other odd things have happened.
Right. I know I can do this because I did it with my son in a restaurant last night. I told him the whole story. So, okay. So you set the table there. So, in fact, Joe Ganim did win by a pretty narrow margin. It was a little, like, sort of between 400 and 500 votes out of 13,000 or so cast in Bridgeport last Wednesday. And all along, the understanding had been that Bill Finch had a backup plan. He had a parachute. And the parachute was that there was something called the Job Creation Party, which existed to create exactly one job, and that would be Bill Finch's job as mayor. So it was called the
How's
Job
it doing?
You know, it was the Job Creation Party, and there were some other guys who he was, fittingly, a used car salesman, who had been nominated as to run for mayor with the Job Creation Party. So the plan all along, and everybody knew it was an open secret in Bridgeport, was that guy steps aside, which he did very early, maybe a little too early. He stepped aside, and so Bill Finch would eventually claim that spot if he needed it, you know, or maybe he could even run on two lines or, you know, a lot of different things. But basically, he'd have a ballot spot where he could run. And so all after the primary results, I mean, all of us had this default understanding that what would happen next would be a general election in which the same two candidates, with or without Mary Jane Foster, the third candidate, plus everybody else who's running for mayor in Bridgeport, which includes some petitioning candidates, something called the New Movement Party, which sounds like a dance troupe, and, of course, the Republican candidate, they'd all run, but that Finch would be in the mix, except that, and this is the difference between, say, Connecticut and King's Landing. You know, there's just not as much paperwork in Game of Thrones. You do have to, it turns out, notify the Secretary of State's office that you are the new candidate for whatever this party is by September 3rd, and they just failed to do that. They didn't do it.
It doesn't count that we talked about it on the Wheelhouse as a possibility, right?
September 2nd.
So that probably will be submitted in court, however, the fact that we talked about it on the Wheelhouse, because, I mean, he now has relatively few options. One of them is to go to court, which he will do. You know, you can always get the right judge, I guess. But, I mean, it's hard to see how he argues this in court. I mean, there's no reason to suppose that the Secretary of State's office has behaved in an arbitrary and capricious manner. I believe, according to, I think, Greg Hladke today, a precedent for this recently in Easton where the same thing happened. It's hard to see what argument he would make. But anyway, as I say, you can always get the right judge and you can luck out. His other option, his other main option, well, I'll just go through his two more of his options. One of them is to try to get somebody who has a line off that line. And so far, everybody has told him to go fry ice. One of the problems with Bridgeport is people are not in the process of sorting out their feelings about other people. People either know that they hate everybody or they like everybody. And so in this case, he can go to Mary Jane Foster. Well, she really hates him. he can go to the Republican candidate, whom he unfortunately, and this is one of these kinds of be nice to the people on the way up because you're going to meet them on the way back down. I mean, they haven't always gotten along all that well, and that man Enrique Torres has felt while on the council is that Bill Finch didn't really pay too much attention to the initiatives that he proposed, many of them being good government initiatives. So they've already had a conversation which didn't go well. I mean, it would be kind of odd if the Republican candidate said, "Oh, sure, no problem. You're a longtime Democrat, but you don't have a line to run on. Why don't you take my line?" I mean, that sort of never happens. And apparently the New Movement Party doesn't feel as though Bill Finch's pirouettes are good enough to. She's out of those options, probably. I mean, you never say never in Bridgeport, right? I mean, it's one thing we've learned this week. Never say never.
Well, his reaction actually was, the quote was, "Whatever the problem is, I'm sure we'll find a way to get on the ballot,"
right?
Which I love as a quote.
So his final option, and then I'll stop, but his final option is to run as a write-in candidate. This is probably the most likely scenario. It's going to be really difficult, for reasons I think we'll get into in the discussion, for him to do this. It's not unheard of. In 2005, Michael Jarjura found himself in a very similar position in Waterbury, but with some significant differences, which we can talk about. And he ran a campaign that was entirely about how to cast a write-in vote. There was no other aspect to this campaign. It was just, this is how you do a write-in vote. And it worked. He collected almost 8,000 write-in votes. As Bridgeport will be, it was a multi-candidate campaign, so that he won with, I think, about 38% of the vote. That's good. If you're going to run as a write-in candidate, you don't want to have to get 51% of the vote. But he got about – and I would just quickly say, 8,000 votes in Bridgeport in a multi-candidate election – if you could get 8,000 write-in votes, you'd be in a pretty okay position. I mean, you'd have a shot at winning. But we'll talk about this later, but I question whether Finch can do this.
I like what Jim Amon and his advice that he had for Bill Finch, according to our friends at the Connecticut Post. So Jim Amon, the former Speaker of the House who lives in Milford, said that Finch can win as a write-in candidate by getting into the neighborhoods and rallying support. And that if he was Finch, he would be knocking on doors until my knuckles are bloody. I mean, Finch has...
the kind of sophisticated analysis Jim is known for.
That's yes. Right. And so I think that, Bill Finch has... obviously, he has to win the support of voters. But then you're right. Like Michael Jarjura, he also has to tell them how to write his name down on a ballot. And luckily, he has an easy name.
That's right. It's not a hard name to spell.
It's not
People
a hard name to spell.
People know who he is. He's been in the city, obviously, for years and years and years as a politician and as a businessman. So just that's...
And I think that would it have to – all the ballots then have to be hand counted?
Oh, my goodness. Hand counting all the ballots in Bridgeport.
Maybe that should be done every election anyway.
Probably. Just as a default.
Yeah. It just seems a huge uphill battle to get that many people. I mean, it's not a huge thing, to go from bubbling in a circle to writing out a name. But we're sort of accustomed to doing elections a certain way. I imagine there are a certain number of people that go into the ballot without a strong sense, really, of who they want to vote for and kind of look at the choices. And if your choice isn't on there, if you've got to, affirmatively write that name down, clearly that's not the choice he would like. I can't imagine the things he's offering to the New Movement Party. Is that,
But this is interesting. And you're whenever we bring you in, Matt, you're our good government guy, right? This is a lot of what you watchdog. It's just interesting that we even have a system where we can talk about the fact that someone can hold a ballot line for someone just in case something goes wrong. And then, as long as you fill out the paperwork right, you can just slide onto the ballot. This seems somehow inconceivable is probably too strong a word. But, I mean, that's where I'll go.
Well, I'll say, I mean, there's nothing wrong with opening up the ballot, to as many people as there can be. And we do have dozens of minor parties, some with literally, fewer than a dozen people in them. So, nothing wrong with challenging the two-party system. And maybe it should be easier to get on the ballot if you have sort of some modicum of support. There is some state law, and I'll take the Secretary of State's word for it, but there's a law I found yesterday suggesting that a nominated candidate maybe can be replaced within 24 or 26 days, something like that. Of this, so
I think the problem is that they don't have a nominated candidate. This is the problem with the used car salesman stepping aside too early. They don't have. In other words, if he did that now, you might be able to invoke that law if he were still on the line. I think this is one of the.
Oh, so he was nominated, but.
Yeah,
but
he's gone.
Maybe too early.
I think this was a tactical error.
It's a tactical error. Here's Joe Ganim actually talking on WPLR yesterday, talking about this whole snafu with Bill Finch's campaign.
Actually, we looked at that. I mean, the fact that they started this with a used car salesman as a front and made kind of a sham out of it, I thought was disrespectful to the voters. And I was very happy that the Secretary of State put a stop to it.
I just want to say, you really know that you've overstepped the boundaries. And Joe Ganim feels as though he can criticize your techniques as a sham that makes a mockery of the system.
It's disrespectful to the voters.
The other way that you know that you've really screwed up is when Ernie Newton says you didn't really think this through very carefully. Those are bad signs.
There really was. There was this priceless photo in the Current of Joe Ganim on election and primary night with Ernie Newton cheering in the foreground and Joe Ganim up on a table, talking to his supporters. It was just
again,
it was Bridgeport.
For our listeners who don't know, Ernie Newton is another former Bridgeport politician who has spent some time in prison. Who may be going back to prison. But you never know. Now, here's the other thing. You mentioned Mary Jane Foster, the third candidate. So she was also on WPLR yesterday. It would have been a good day to be listening to WPLR. Here she is
not
talking.
Not if Bruce Barber isn't on anymore.
Here she is talking about the fact that she essentially said earlier this week, I'm not going to get in this race. I'm going to get out. I'm going to drop my name off the ballot in November. Now she's maybe reconsidering.
Given the incompetence of the Finch team on this job creation party issue, not to mention the total lack of transparency, I have to seriously reconsider my decision.
Okay, so she makes, and Matt has also made this point too, that one of the problems that Finch is going to have when he goes to court, including the fact that he has no leg to stand on, he has no particular cogent argument to make, is that basically he's going into court and saying, I was going to play this trick, and now they're not going to let me. Which tends not to really sound that great, right? I mean, it just sort of like, it's hard to cast yourself as a victim of an injustice if you, in fact, were planning to play a trick on people in the first place and now they're telling you
like
you can't.
It's kind of like cheating in taxes, though, isn't it?
Well, kind of, yeah. Everybody does it. So here's the thing with Foster. All right, so Tom Swan, who is her strategic advisor, is saying that she should get back into the race and talking about, he had a quote in the Current about the vitriol and anger towards Bill Finch that they encountered when they were door knocking, making their knuckles, Jim Amon, bloody, knocking on doors and hearing all this hatred of Bill Finch. And I was reading that quote and I was thinking, you only got 1,177 votes out of 13,000 or so votes cast, despite the fact that, according to you, one of the guys you were running against is hated, and the other guy is basically Whitey Bulger with a law degree, and you got less than 10% of the vote. So that tends not to make your candidacy look so strong. And I think that's the problem with Foster getting back in. I don't see how that works at all, and I don't see how that helps anybody. I think the most interesting person right now is Enrique Iglesias, the Republican nominee, because he – one of the many problems is, and I'm going to geek out about this a little bit, he and Foster and Finch are all kind of fighting all over the same bunch of votes. I think if Brian Lockhart were here, he would say the same thing, that Ganim basically has locked down or done much better than Finch anyway in most of the neighborhoods of Bridgeport. So in Black Rock and one of the central districts, this is where – Iglesias has support, Finch has support, Foster has support. So you don't want them fighting over this tiny little pool of votes. You want some kind of coalition candidate. I think Iglesias at this point is the most plausible one. But it's going to be really hard, whether Finch gets in or not, to beat Ganim. Ganim now can fish out a lot of ponds, and everybody else is kind of fighting over the same tiny little pond. And I just – it's hard for me to see – I mean, Bridgeport is like it's sui generis. It's if either you understand it or you don't, and I don't. I don't live there. I don't get it. But looking at it from a conventional, sort of election analysis point of view, it's really hard to see how Ganim doesn't win this.
So I just want to, before we move on from Bridgeport, I just want to ask Matt and Christine quickly about something. As Colin knows, I often invoke a fictional character I call Deep River Guy. And Deep River Guy is a guy who listens to our station who doesn't really care necessarily about politics in Hartford or Bridgeport, doesn't really know any of the players. And I'm wondering if there's a case to be made for why this is so very important. Obviously, Bridgeport's the biggest city by population in the state. There's an awful lot of political ramifications all the way up to the state capitol around this, Christine. But make a case for why paying attention to what's happening right now Bridgeport is something that we should all be paying attention to.
I mean, Bridgeport is the connector, I guess, between Stamford and Greenwich and Hartford, and they've got a ton of economic development going on right now. And what happens in Bridgeport matters because whoever is mayor is going to have to have a relationship with the governor. And at this point, the governor doesn't even want to touch this with a 10-foot pole because he doesn't even want to imagine that Ganim could be the mayor.
Not a 10-foot pole, not a pole of any length, I don't think. Right. Matt?
Yeah, this is a terrible time for Malloy to have pushed his second chance society because it just has made sort of too many sound bites with Joe Ganim. But it's important in that context to think about do we forgive someone who reached his arm and then had like a prosthetic arm reach in as well, into the cookie jar? I mean, he just redefined, and he was like a decent guy early on, a reformer, a good government guy, and just turned so 180 degrees. And so I think it's important to talk about these issues of, is this a forgivable sin? What is it? Does it say something about municipalities that will entertain, a candidate like that? And I think there are broader issues that are worth a real discussion.
I just chime in and say I think these things are what they both said just now are really important. And so Bridgeport also, I'm not a huge Bill Finch fan or anything like that, but there's some important things that are getting done in Bridgeport right now. I would point especially to the so-called eco-industrial park or whatever you call it, where they're just really kind of trying to tie together brownfield reclamation and mattress recycling and the employment of the formerly incarcerated people, and they got tilapia and tanks. And I mean, they're doing a lot of really interesting stuff there. And if Ganim becomes mayor, I'm not saying it'll all grind to a halt, but obviously a very different vision will come into place, and their ability to go up to the state capitol or to Washington and get funding is almost inevitably going to be compromised. I mean, just how if you're a bureaucrat in Washington, how if you're the General Assembly or the governor, are you super comfortable dumping a lot of cash into Joe Ganim's hands, at least at first, until, the freakishness of this wears off? I think that's a significant problem and one that the city of Bridgeport will probably wind up facing. I do also want to say one last thing, which is that I am, on the other hand, really uncomfortable, and certain editorial writers and columnists have sort of said the people of Bridgeport, the voters of Bridgeport, should be ashamed of themselves for voting for Joe Ganim. I don't like that kind of rhetoric. I mean, first of all, municipal politics, they're really, really local. And if you're not on the ground, if you're not living the reality, you don't always understand why people vote the way that they do. And I think in Bridgeport, that's especially true. But I think also cities, they're allowed to elect whoever they're going to elect, as long as it's a clean election, or in the case of Bridgeport, a reasonably clean election. People should feel free to vote for whoever they want to vote for. And I don't think it's our business in the press to tell voters they should be ashamed of who they chose. They choose who they choose. They choose their leaders.
There's also a distinction in, was this a pro-Ganim vote or was this an anti-Finch vote?
Right.
And so I think some of the anti-Finch votes went to Mary Jane Foster. Some of them went to Ganim. Obviously, some of the voters did vote for Ganim, but there's that aspect too.
Well, I will say we're just getting a note from the control room here. A few people have called in and said just a reminder that the Republican candidate is Enrique Torres, not as you call him, Enrique Iglesias, which I think which is actually would be another twist in this
right.
campaign if we could write in Enrique Iglesias for mayor. Yesterday, by the way, Hartford Mayor Pedro Segarra announced his campaign plans for the general election after losing the Democratic primary to Luke Bronin.
For the good of the city and in order to bring unity to the city, I am announcing that I am ending my campaign. And as a proud, almost lifelong resident of the city, I ask that we all, as Democrats, come together and that we support my colleague, Luke Bronin, for mayor.
So that's Pedro Segarra stepping away, essentially meaning Luke Bronin will likely be the next mayor of the city of Hartford. Any surprise, Matt, that that Pedro Segarra decided to make this announcement after really losing fairly handily in the primary?
Yeah, I don't think anyone was surprised. If there was any surprise, it was sort of how long it took him to make the announcement. It wasn't a huge amount of time, but I suspect he just needed time to sort of, you know, come to grips with the reality of it. I mean, it's not likely that he would have won in the general election. I think he would have needed a radically different campaign strategy, but frankly would have had to have realized that well before the primary election. We didn't sort of see a change in his strategy. So not a surprise, at least to me and to the folks I've talked with.
And so what are some of the reactions that you're hearing to this, Christine?
You know, the reaction is that, you know, obviously Pedro, you know, he could have continued. He did have, unlike Bill Finch, he had secured a spot on the November ballot. And, you know, I think that Malloy endorsing, staying out of the primary and then endorsing Luke after Luke won the primary made a big difference. You know, the Democratic Party wouldn't say what Governor Malloy asked Mayor Segarra to do. But it's likely that he asked him to step aside and allow Luke to run on the ballot against the Republican.
And so what happens next for the mayor of Hartford?
Well, first of all, the thing that happens next is his life gets better. And, you know, Pedro Segarra is a good guy. I mean, nobody ever really questioned that he was a nice person. And I think one of the words that you heard in that clip was proud. And I think one of the things that's been hard about this particular cycle for him is that his pride really has been injured. You know, I mean, they're just inevitably this election came down to arguments about competence and the way the city was run. And I think it was very hard for him to hear the words that were said about him. But that's over. And pretty soon running the city of Hartford will be over, too. I think he will feel a burden will be lifted from him. A long, long time ago, I think it might have been 4 years ago, as a previous mayoral election cycle was heating up, there was a lot of talk about, well, you know, he never really wanted to be mayor that much in the first place. He's basically Frodo. They gave him the ring. They told him he had to keep it. What he really wants to be is a superior court judge. I heard that from a lot of people. And I'm thinking one of the nice things, I mean, if that's what he wants to be and things have ended peaceably and he said some nice things about Luke Bronin. So what's next for Mayor Segarra? I wouldn't be surprised if a year from or so from now he were Judge Segarra. And I think he'll probably be a much better judge than he was a mayor.
And a very good guy who, as Colin said, always certainly treated us well. And we wish him the best of luck. As we take a break, we want to let you know that you can get in touch with us at Where We Live on Facebook and Twitter. We're in the Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. We're talking with Colin McEnroe, Matt Kaufman of The Current, Christine Stewart of CTNewsJunkie.com. When we come back, some big budget cuts announced this week by the governor. It has, well, just about everybody kind of upset. That's next in the Wheelhouse, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today is Wednesday, The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. So we're joined by Matt Kaufman, who's an investigative reporter for The Hartford Current, Christine Stewart, who's the editor of CTNewsJunkie.com, and our own Colin McEnroe, who is the host of The Colin McEnroe Show, which you can hear at 1 o'clock weekdays here on WMPR. What's on your show today, Colin?
Well, you know, there's a term that some people know, some people don't. Woo-woo. Woo-woo is a term used by scientists and scientific people to sort of stigmatize ideas that they think are not very scientific, that exist in the world of New Age or spirituality or just sort of, you know, anything that that strikes them as not able to stand up to the rigors of scientific inquiry. We're going to kind of investigate and probe that term a little bit, pull it apart and see how the world decides what's scientific and what is woo-woo. So this is our long-awaited woo-woo show.
The Woo-Woo Show this afternoon at 1 o'clock with Colin McEnroe. Now, late last week, State Budget Chief Ben Barnes announced his office would rescind nearly $103 million from the 2016 state budget. A Republican Senate Minority Leader Len Fasano joined other lawmakers and hospital officials affected by the cuts to criticize the governor's budget cuts.
And what we saw last session was four times the governor used his rescission authority to change the budget. All of it, or most of it, hurt those who needed the services more than anybody in the state. Now, if we're just 3 months into this budget and already we have a problem, we shouldn't solve it, as Representative Clarida said accurately, by patchwork.
So, Christine, there's the Republicans saying, we don't know where these budget cuts are coming from. We're not happy with them. But honestly, it wasn't just Republicans. It was also hospital officials. It was some town officials. And it was Democrats from both chambers basically saying, we don't love these cuts. What happened here?
Yeah. So the Malloy administration, for whatever reason, so about $103 million were rescinded from the current budget. The revenue projections were lowered, and $63.4 million, which ends up being $190 million when you take in the federal reimbursement, was cut from the hospitals, which is about 40% of their funding. For whatever reason, we don't really understand why, but Governor Malloy doesn't exactly like the hospitals.
Well, and here's what he says, and we'll probably get into this a little bit. I mean, his spokesperson was talking once again, and it's something we've heard about the high compensation for the executives of the hospitals. Essentially, they've been saying for a while, hospitals are making money in this state hand over fist. We don't need to be helping them with a whole bunch of state money. This is a place where we can trim back the budget, in part, he said, because we're looking at Wall Street. We're looking at softness in the economy. Maybe this is the time to cut.
That would be great, except what's happened with the payment structure in the healthcare system is it hasn't gotten there yet. So we still have 1 in 5 residents in Connecticut who are on Medicaid. So the government has to reimburse the hospitals for these patients. And if it's not reimbursing the hospitals for these patients already below cost, it's reimbursing them for the patients, then the hospitals are going to have a hard time figuring this out, because what has happened is the Affordable Care Act and the private insurance hasn't caught up necessarily with the lack of funding provided by Medicaid.
The hospital spokespeople are saying that there's going to be job cuts pretty soon after this. Even Martin Looney, the Senate president, the Democrat, says, I'm deeply disappointed in the cuts made to hospitals and Medicaid reimbursements. I hope the governor will reconsider, Matt.
Yeah, it's sort of interesting, this coalition of Republicans who don't like the cuts, partly because they don't like the governor, and
largely
Democrats
because they don't like the governor.
Perhaps, yeah.
Yeah,
and Democrats who don't like the cuts because they don't like cuts. That they feel sort of hit social services and the like. This is a difficult one. I think there was a 7.1% projected increase in personal income tax. That seems a ridiculous projection, and probably one that just perfectly got them to a balanced budget. The market has done badly. I've reduced my own spending by about $103 million, based on what the S&P 500 has done since May.
You didn't even have breakfast this morning from what you told us.
Exactly. And I buy lunch at the dollar store. But it's tough to make cuts when there is a federal reimbursement that is sort of multiplying the effect of that cuts, and when it's in a program. I mean, I think he makes a decent point. Compensations are very high in the hospitals. I mean, even the Hospital Association, Jennifer Jackson, last accounting, $750,000 between the different things. I mean, that's a lot of money, and certainly people running hospitals making not just $1 million but multiple millions. On the other hand, Medicaid, there's sort of a certain formula there. There are people in Connecticut who need it, and it's kind of tough to kind of pull the rug out of that. And I'm not sure where the money is supposed to come in from. And if hospitals are simply assumed, you got enough profit, take it out of that.
Well, and Colin, we have been hearing that for a while from the Malloy administration and other places, and it's certainly something we've taken quite a look at on the program as well, about how much hospitals are paying people to run them. Maybe that's something that government needs to look at. But as Len Fasano just said in that cut, we're just a couple months into a budget that seemed to be balanced on the backs of some projections. And as Matt said, maybe those projections just weren't really accurate projections to start with.
Right. So, Wolfie, I think we do have another cut. And this is Jennifer Jackson reacting, her initial reaction to those cuts to the hospital budget. Do we have that?
Uh-oh. This is bad, 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 bad.
So here's the thing. You don't want to have, when your house is on fire, a conversation with the firemen about how much money they make. So there's a conversation to be had about the salaries of executives at hospitals, whether or not hospitals are truly nonprofit institutions when they claim to be nonprofit institutions,
yes.
Whether or not they should be eligible for property tax exemptions. That's a conversation worth having. Not right now, not when your budget's on fire. And see, one of the aspects of this chaotic budget process where they claim the budget balances, but it doesn't really the slightest nudge from anywhere. You know, if Matt decides not to have lunch today, you know, they get like a whole other problem. So, you know, one of the problems is that it devolves very quickly into kind of name calling and accusation. So, yeah, you've got Malloy going, well, maybe if some of these executives would take a pay cut, we could do this. And then they're going, well, you give tax breaks to corporations to make more money than we do. So it's like, this doesn't really sound great, you know? This doesn't really sound like a state that understands how to get through the budget-making process. So, I mean, they're kind of both wrong, but I think the state's wronger. The state hasn't moved beyond what Ben Barnes called the permanent state of fiscal crisis. That's where they are right now. So anytime a squirrel runs across the road and people hit the brakes, they've got a problem. Wall Street, as if Danny Haar were here, what Danny would say is that, you know, I mean, slowdowns in Wall Street shouldn't affect your revenue stream that much, except the way that Matt was talking about in terms of slowing down spending a little bit. But, I mean, people – those things aren't realized until people sell, you know, and they don't do a lot of selling in a situation like that. That's where the pain really starts to come. Ultimately, this is an argument for a sounder version of budget making.
And, you know, so the Republicans do have a point, you know. Malloy only has the power to cut so much from the budget. There's only so many pots of money that he can touch. He can't touch municipal aid. He can't touch entitlements. So, you know, why don't we as a legislature, whose job it is to watch over this budget, get back together and figure out where we are?
Yeah.
Because we weren't where we are 4 months ago when we finished this budget.
But you both seem to be arguing for a more sensible way of creating state budgets. And I just – there's nothing in my experience, Matt, has primed me to think that that's anything that's going to happen anytime in our lifetime. And I don't know when we ever get to that, right? Now we're at the start of a new budget, and this might be a time to have that conversation about how to actually budget the right way the next time. And we're already starting on the wrong foot.
Right. So the time that might happen is when we don't have one-party rule in Connecticut. I mean, we've seen, at all levels of government, there's an efficiency to not doing things democratically. And so I think the Republicans make a decent point in saying, can we get a seat at the table? Can we do this in sort of a more transparent, a more democratic, more inclusive fashion? And who knows? Maybe we would, end up probably not. Maybe we would end up in a better situation with a more sustainable budget.
You know, Matt, I would push back against that tiny bit and say that I think this is a bigger failure because we have one-party rule. With one-party rule, you have a chance to input a budget theory, a theory of your budget. This is what we're going to do. These people are going to feel pain. These people are going to feel less pain. We're preserving these priorities. These are the important things. We're not going to hurt those things. You have a chance actually to work out with between the governor and the legislative leadership a theory of the budget and then a message that goes down to your troops. And that didn't happen this time. I mean, those of us who are walking the halls of the state legislature on the last night of the session heard that a lot from legislators. We don't know what this is supposed to be. We don't know what the theory is. There's no overarching message here. It's harder to do in a two-party situation because ultimately you're preserving a bunch of different stakeholder priorities. Here, you really have the chance to unite people, unite your majority around a particular idea, but there is no idea.
Well, right. I think Democratic lawmakers were upset because they thought that they had preserved this hospital funding. They thought that they had preserved, the municipal aid, and all of a sudden they learned from their governor that they didn't.
See football, comma, Charlie Brown, comma, Lucy.
Yeah. Right.
With one-party rule, you can also, though, get away with creating a phonier budget.
Right.
You know, and so where you have something
point
that
taken.
When you, see a little drop, and not a little, a significant drop in the projected revenue or in the stock market that leads you to say, uh-oh, hey, let's say this is the reason our, revenue projections aren't going to get there. You can sort of get away with kind of that false premise or at least weak premise.
My only thought, Colin, is that your proposed budget unification theory sounds like woo-woo to me.
It is a woo-woo.
We'll be talking about woo-woo this afternoon on the Colin McEnroe Show. So the state budget contains a lot of moving numbers. So do the ridership stats for CT Fast Track. That's the busway that was built with some opposition over the course of the last couple of years. A lot of people are excited about this busway that goes from New Britain into Hartford. Matt, you asked a couple questions at the start of a recent report. Is CT Fast Track a success, and is it earning its estimated $567 million price tag? What did you find out?
Well, you know, we raised those questions without an intention of asking them, but you know, we've had three press conferences, I think, sort of touting the success of CT Fast Track. And so I'm a numbers guy. We wanted to kind of dig a little deeper into the numbers and get a sense of, you know, is it working and how good are the state's numbers. So the state had said they projected 11,200 riders within about a year of the system. We're saying, hey, we're getting 14,000, you know, trips a day, and we're doing really well. And as we dug a little deep, we found out, one, the 11,000 number is kind of uses a model, a forecasting model that sort of notoriously underestimates. The state knew they were going to, in the state's own words, blow that number out of the water. And the 14,000, maybe even ridden up to 16,000 by now, there's sort of two important things to keep in mind there, that 16,000 count includes trips taken on buses that were already in service, sort of in the corridor before CT Fast Track, only about 8,000 new trips at max, 6,000 to 8,000, and that those 6,000 to 8,000 trips are one-way trips. Actually, they're single trips. If there's a transfer, that's actually two trips. Most people are taking the bus round trip, so we're really talking more in the range of 3,000 to 4,000 new riders. I'm not saying whether that's good or bad. I just think that people sort of have a good sense of it. We've done a story a week earlier, looking at the question of, is this going to move cars specifically off I-84, which many people believe that was sort of a key purpose of the busway. The state insists, one, we haven't looked at those numbers. They wouldn't give us sort of hourly numbers. We could take a look at how crowded are the buses during rush hour. Does it look like we're getting some cars moving off? And then further said, and frankly, the busway never should have been sold as a congestion mitigation project anyway, despite quotes where they said, this is the best congestion mitigation project we can put forward there. So, yeah, lots of people are excited about rapid transit. Nothing not to be excited about the concept of rapid transit. We just want to do some kind of a reality check on how they're truly doing.
Well, and I think one thing that you said, it's hard to really figure out how many cars are getting off the roads. Even that statistic, we knew that there were some people that were already going to be taking the bus and that now they'd be taking this new Fast Track bus on basically the same route. Yeah, probably it makes sense to calculate how many hours saved. You could probably do a whole analysis if you wanted to about dollars saved, economic boost from all this. But it's a hard thing, and it's going to take a lot longer than just a couple months that the busway's been open, really.
That's right. It'll be a couple of years before we get sort of a full analysis of this. And indeed, ridership is not the only, you know, way on which the busway should be evaluated. I mean, it has indeed made commuting possible for some people. It has made commuting easier for some people. And I think we're starting to see, at least there are claims that we're seeing, some economic development benefit for, you know, say a couple of restaurants, for example, along the route. This may spur some transit-oriented development, you know, along the corridor that would be helpful. It's also, however, going to cost, we'll have more details on this relatively soon, more than the state thought it was going to cost, even on an ongoing basis. So all of this is against this backdrop of trying to evaluate, not even was this a good investment, because, you know, you don't look at pure return on investment with transit projects, but nothing comes free, and it's important to evaluate these things with kind of eyes wide open.
Well, like we were talking about the federal reimbursements earlier with health care, you know, there's an awful lot of federal money baked into this plan, and so that was part of it. Christine, along with all this, as we either celebrate or question some of these numbers, the state is looking to expand the busway.
It is looking to expand the busway. So on next week's bond commission agenda, there's $7 million to expand it to east of the river. So expanding the busway east of the river isn't exactly building another dedicated bus-only lane. It's using the HOV lanes that already exist on I-84.
The underutilized HOV lanes. Any takeaways from all this, Colin?
Well, the big takeaway is to the Hartford Yard Goats, when you're getting ready to release your attendance figures, Matt Kaufman is waiting for you. Don't lie to us. You know, the one thing that I would say about this is that Matt is right about the congestion reduction or congestion mitigation strategy. I mean, We just know from looking all across the country that the way that this works is you make it unattractive to drive on the highway. Of course, I think that's our next topic. We're about to make it really unattractive to drive on the highway. But you make it unattractive to drive on the highway by congestion pricing and stuff like that. You charge people money to use the highway at times when you don't want them to use the highway. And then you give them an alternative. So we've built one of the alternatives. That's what CT Fast Track is. But Matt's absolutely right. All by itself, it's not going to make people go jump on those buses. They've got to have another reason besides the fact that they hate sitting in their cars, you know, listening to CDs. I mean, they don't hate it enough to get on the bus in the kinds of numbers we would like to see them do. But they will if you give them yet another disincentive. It's going to be very politically unpopular to create that kind of disincentive. But statewide, that's ultimately what has to happen. Congestion pricing and mass transit alternatives, that combination is the only one that consistently works at reducing traffic jams.
And the DOT is going to solve this because they are actually leaning towards shutting down I-84 in order to redo the viaduct in Hartford. So they're leaning towards shutting it down completely because construction will happen faster. And a lot of the tunneling options are off the table, and they're thinking about doing it at grade.
Although commuters are free to dig their own tunnels if they can't
exactly.
get to work. But they can do it themselves.
They may run into a river down there.
We've had some of this conversation, though, about what at grade means. We've been talking about, does I-84 get completely shut down and they dig a trench and then there's highways over it? Or are we talking about, like, at grade, like a big old highway cutting through the city with those sound barriers up on either side?
Yep, that's it.
That's what we're talking about?
That's what we're talking about, yeah.
Well, okay, so we need to take
that's a whole nother show.
That's a whole seven shows in a row if we want to talk about that. So
it's hard to see how that's a win, though.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
It's a win for CT Fast Track.
It's a big win for CT Fast Track. Look, when we come back, we're going to be talking about another plan that's been on the books for just a little bit here. Connecticut got into a partnership with the state tribes. They want to build a new casino to keep people from driving on the highway to go up to Springfield. Now it looks like that MGM Springfield Casino isn't quite as grand as MGM said it might be. That's one of the things we'll talk about coming up next in The Wheelhouse Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up tomorrow, high turnover rates in police departments nationwide might be attributable to changes in police pensions demanded by lawmakers and taxpayers. That's something that's according to criminal justice expert John DiCarlo. He's a former police chief in Brantford. He's written a new book about his research on unions. He'll join us to talk about this issue and also the issues of training police in a changing America. That's tomorrow's program here on Where We Live. A few other notes quickly. Online right now, there's a live streaming of the Pope's visit, and we're going to have more coverage on NPR and WNPR of the Pope's visit to Washington and New York over the course of the next few days. Also want to draw your attention to a story up by our friend Jamil Ragland, who works with us. It's an obituary remembrance of Butch Lewis, yet another Hartford legend who passed away in the last week. We remembered one last week, and we have another one up at WNPR.org. Connecticut officials are using a lot of war metaphors when it comes to their battle with Massachusetts over a casino that's planned to be built in Springfield. They want to build a third tribal casino in the state of Connecticut, somewhere between Hartford and maybe Enfield, to try to capture all those people who are driving north to this brand new plan. Meanwhile, it looks as though within the last few days here, Colin, MGM, that's the company that's going to be building this casino in Springfield, has scaled way back on their plan. They were going to build a 25-story tower, and now it seems like they're going to build a much smaller venture. A lot of people, including people in Springfield, are wondering what this is all about. Do you think this has anything to do with this border war that we're talking about here?
No, I think it has to do with the bad economic model of basing your state's economic bright future at all, even partially, on an industry that's in decline. I mean, this is sort of like, you know, ranching some kind of butterfly that's about to become extinct or something. I mean, basically, casino handles are just going down, right? So, I mean, Massachusetts is indulging in the greater folly in suggesting that they can really get a lot of milk out of this cow. You can't get a lot of milk out of this cow. The industry's overbuilt. The novelty's worn off. The handles are going down. You know, it's a cow whose udders are slowly drying up. And so,
Thanks.
I guess that was a little bit too vivid. But.
The most expansive cow metaphor we've had for some time.
I forgot that one of our guests was lactating. That was a bad image. But that's the problem. And it's the folly here in Connecticut, too, the idea that they keep saying they're trying to protect jobs. No, they're not. They're trying to protect a pool of money from which the state derives revenue. But that pool is shrinking. It's going to shrink.
Christine, any thoughts from up at the Capitol about any of this? Because, again, the state is signing this deal with the tribes. The tribes are just on my show earlier this week talking about the necessity of doing this, although they were very clear to say, you know, this law that got passed, it doesn't mean we're going to build a casino. It just means we can explore the possibility of building a casino somewhere in that I-91 corridor. Do you think that this MGM scale back, does this change anything at the state capitol?
I'm not sure it changes anything, and I think that, you know, MGM is arguing that it's the same number of hotel rooms, even though the scale of the building is much smaller and turned on its side. I'm not sure what this signals, if anything. The tribe signed their agreement, their joint business venture a few weeks ago, and I don't think anybody's thinking about it right now except for the municipalities who want this casino.
We just have a couple minutes left, and I want to get to sort of the big story of the week. And it turns out that when the Pope visits Washington, D.C. and New York and Philadelphia, there's a lot of people from Connecticut, including a lot of politicians who are going to be there. Governor Malloy is one of the thousands welcoming the Pope on his first trip to the U.S. Has he talked about this at all, Christine, about his meeting with the Pope?
He has not. I do have a call scheduled with him later on today to talk about the visit. But he's one of 15,000 people, I believe, waiting for the Pope.
You know, and one thing just to bring up with this, Matt, is it's sort of hard to overlook the impact that this visit has had on politics across America, because this Pope represents a whole bunch of very new ideas, certainly for a papal visit. But he's making Republicans uncomfortable. He's making Democrats uncomfortable. He's making social liberals uncomfortable, and he's making longtime conservatives uncomfortable. And there's something really great about that, I feel.
I was going to say that's what good leaders do. Agree, disagree. I mean, it's valuable to have someone with enough clout to, get a seat at any table he wants a seat at, and challenging some conventional wisdom, for better or worse. And it doesn't mean you have to agree with him or change policy as a result of it. But certainly some of the stuff he's talking about, the sort of, North versus South divide in the world that we in America don't typically think about in the way we think of East versus West, is interesting.
And it's also interesting, Christine, he's making a real point to stop at prisons and jails. He's been doing this all over the world. This plays into Governor Malloy's Second Chance Society that we mentioned earlier, this sense that you don't just throw people away because you put them in jail.
It does. And he's also coming at a time where there was just a story today that, he's very involved in the poor and making sure that the poor are thriving in a way. What we saw was that this federal government shutdown may impact food stamps.
Sure, sure.
So he's coming at a time when that's a reality for people in Washington.
There's
actually
real
and
impacts
here
for people. Yeah, and he can make a case. Colin?
First of all, we all call Governor Malloy the porcupine, and the Pope, I think, has his own nickname for Governor Malloy, which is who?
That's not very nice.
I don't think he makes everybody equally uncomfortable. I think Pope Francis, we all need heroes. Mine used to be Bill Finch, but Pope Francis is kind of a hero for me right now.
But your hero is Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, well, Bernie Sanders too, goes without saying. But I don't think he makes everybody equally uncomfortable. It's clear what his batting order here is. He wants to talk about economic injustice. He wants to talk about climate change. And then there's like all the reproductive and sexual stuff where maybe he's, not on the same page with a lot of liberals. But that's lower on the batting order for him. His message is a very strong one. And, he doesn't just care about the poor. He also cares about wealth. And he said to the religious in Cuba, wealth impoverishes you spiritually. He really is against the accumulation of capital in a way that disadvantages the rest of society. But he also thinks it's bad for people. It's bad for people to care about material wealth all the time. So that's quite a radical message for the USA.
Yeah. At the same time as the Catholic Church wants you to tie, 10%, 15% of your income to the church.
Well, he has been called by many people a Marxist, and I heard this yesterday in response to some of these accusations that have been levied against him. He essentially said, every single thing that I say, about the poor and about income inequality is something that you can find in Catholic teachings. And if you don't believe me, I'm very happy to quote scripture for you. And this is one of the things about this pope that's going to be so interesting to hear is he brings a lot of passion, certainly, for these issues, but he also brings an awful lot of data, and he wants to talk about these things in a very real way. It should be interesting over the course of the next couple of days. Live coverage on WNPR.org of his visit. Tomorrow we'll have live coverage on the radio on WNPR as well. I want to thank our panelists for The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. Matt Kaufman, investigative reporter for The Hartford Current. Thank you so much, Matt.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Thanks also to Christine Stewart, editor of CTNewsJunkie.com. Thank you, Christine.
Thank you, Mr. Dankowski.
And thank you, Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR.
Happy birthday, Khaleesi.
Yes, indeed. Happy birthday. Our program is always produced by Tucker Ives with Lydia Brown, Betsy Kaplan, and Josh Nalea. Kyone Wolf is our technical producer. Heather Brandon is the digital editor. The executive producer of Where We Live is Katie Talarski. Safe travels, Katie. This is Where We Live.